This is an ABC podcast.
Should juries in child sex abuse trials hear about an accused's prior convictions? That discussion coming up shortly. I'm Damien Carrick. Welcome to the Law Report. First, to a holiday home which exploded on Queensland's Bribie Island. Now, normally when a case is heard by the High Court of Australia, the judges don't give a decision on the spot. But recently they did something unusual. After hearing legal arguments in the case of Eamon Coughlin, they immediately overturned his convictions and ordered his immediate release from jail. Coughlin, an ex-London policeman who represented himself at his criminal trial, had been found guilty of arson and attempted fraud. Mark Thomas was junior counsel for Eamon Coughlin in the High Court appeal.
Okay, I probably need to go back quite a way to create a picture of who he is. You can guess from the name that he's Irish, but I'm going to take you back to two decades ago when he's in England and he's a serving member of the Metropolitan Police in London. When Judge Clare sentenced him, she referred to the fact that he had an admirable record in policing and ethical standards. He settled, when he came to Australia, in Narangbar, just north of Brisbane, with his wife and family, a couple of children, and he bought a holiday home on the island of Bribie, which is just nearby. And it was the holiday home on Bribie that was the subject of the explosion.
Let's talk about what happened on the 18th of July 2015 at this holiday house on Bribie Island, which is just near Brisbane.
Yeah, okay. He'd gone up to the holiday home to actually sell a bike for someone he knew. He'd advertised it on Gumtree, and he was a little bit concerned about scams that occur with online sales. And so he was very cautious. He parked the bike a short way, about a 2-minute walk away from the holiday home. After a while, it became apparent that the guy wasn't going to turn up. He hung around, I think, for about an hour. He didn't have his keys with him, so he couldn't get into the house. He read the paper and then decided that the guy wasn't going to show and went to leave. And as he was walking down the front pass to the main road, the house exploded, literally. It wasn't a fire in the conventional sense, it was an explosion. He was knocked to the ground, he suffered third-degree burns to his back, some slightly lesser burns to his left-hand side and hand, and some very mild facial burns, described as flash burns. He, for a number of reasons, thought that he was the target of the explosion rather than just the house. And so he went down, he picked up the bike, and he left Bribie Island. He didn't go home because he was concerned that if someone was following him or there was a problem of that nature, he didn't want to take the problem home to his family. And so he tried to put off anyone he thought might be following him. He stopped somewhere and washed his face and hands in relation to the burns, and then subsequently went to the police station and presented to the police station, dressed as he had been all that day. He didn't change his clothes. He didn't ditch the bag he had with him. So there was no attempt to disguise the fact that he'd been at the site of the fire.
And he turned up to the police station about 2.5, 3 hours after
it was,
the
It was somewhere
explosion.
Around about 2.5 hours, yeah.
That was his version of events, but police built a case against him and he was found guilty at trial by a jury. Yeah. They found him guilty of both arson and insurance fraud.
Yeah.
Now, he appealed to the Queensland Court of Appeal, and in April last year, the court unanimously rejected that appeal.
Yeah.
In July, he was sentenced to 3.5 years prison, I think to be suspended after 12 or 15 months, I think.
It was 12 months, yeah.
And then his legal team, you being one of them, then appealed to the High Court, and the High Court heard your arguments and then at that point said, we're basically acquitting him on the spot, which is very unusual. Normally they go off and think carefully.
They normally have some time to think about it and hand their decisions down.
They said, look, hearing what we're hearing, we're replacing the guilty verdict with a not guilty verdict. Yeah. And we're saying the real effect of it, they don't use these words, I get him out of prison now.
Yeah. He doesn't belong in prison because he's now been acquitted. Yeah.
And of course, we don't know what the reasoning of the High Court will be, but they were responding to your arguments that the guilty verdict was unsafe and unreasonable and no jury could reasonably reach a guilty verdict on the evidence presented. Mark Thomas, can we walk through just some of the big issues or the main reasons why you say that the guilty verdict was unsafe and unreasonable? Let's talk first about witness accounts.
The witness accounts weren't necessarily followed up as much as they perhaps should have been. the chief investigating officer for the police expressed during, I think, the second trial that he hated Eamon and that he never even entertained the thought that someone else had been responsible for the fire. And so the investigation was, in one sense, tainted from the start because it started out with the assumption that Eamon was the only person who could have possibly committed the offence. And yet there were other people who were at the scene who disappeared, whose identity was never established, whose reason for being there was never established because they simply weren't followed up on. There were other witnesses who had been at an earlier arson of Eamon's car some 3 months earlier and were now at the scene of the house explosion. They were never really fully investigated. Two of them never even gave statements to the police. One of them gave a statement 2 years later.
I think there were two witnesses who described somebody who didn't fit the appellant's description at the property at the time.
There were four witnesses who gave fairly consistent descriptions of someone who was quite clearly Eamon. It was never disputed that it was Eamon that they were describing and that he was moving along a path towards the bike up near the main road. There were two other witnesses who were on a minor road parallel to the main road who described someone leaving the general vicinity and getting on a motorbike and leaving, who was nowhere like Eamon. I think he was described as being different in six major domains. You know, things like height. Eamon was either clean-shaven or had stubble. This guy had a beard, which was described by one of the witnesses as reaching to mid-chest. The clothing was different. The backpack was different. So you had two witnesses who were giving a description of someone who quite clearly wasn't Eamon leaving the scene.
So you had these wildly divergent witness accounts. There was also the question of a forensic evidence, the forensic evidence from the actual site of the fire, the actual remains of the house, and also petrol, which was found on Eamon's clothing. Just walk me through both of those very quickly.
Okay, if we look at the house, those of us who've grown up and are now watching CSI programs on television possibly have an inflated view of how precise forensic examination is. When you look at this, no forensic examination was carried out on the footprint of the house. The reason given for that was that there was asbestos in the wet areas, and therefore it would be unsafe to go onto the property to do those tests which you would ordinarily expect would be done. As a result of that, there was no evidence taken, for example, from samples from the site, which would have established what the fuel for the fire was. The police alleged that it was petrol, but the police experts couldn't exclude the possibility that it was a gas-fired explosion from, say, a leaking main or from a gas bottle that was nearby. There was no examination of the electrical system of the house to establish whether or not an electrical fault might have been the ignition source. It was never established where the fire actually started or what was the ignition point from which the explosion emanated. So when the police came to lead their case, they couldn't actually say how the explosion occurred. They couldn't establish either that Eamon had ever been inside the house. And he, in fact, had said, and it was never contradicted, that he didn't have the keys and couldn't get inside the house. So you've got a serious problem, at least in our view, when we put the case to the High Court, that if the police can't establish what the fuel source was for the explosion, then the fact that they might have found petrol on his shoes is of really no significance, because there are any number of ways which you can quite innocently get petrol on your shoes. I mowed the lawn yesterday afternoon. I'm pretty certain I splashed petrol onto my shoes when I did it. He said he'd been using a leaf blower that morning. So the innocent explanations were never discounted. And in fact, the Chief Justice asked the Crown during the High Court hearing, if you take out the petrol fuel flyer and the petrol on his shoes, what are you left with? And the Crown's response was, well, his house exploded and he was nearby. And that's not really a strong case to convict someone and send them to prison for a year.
And when the High Court Chief Justice asked that question, that's the point during the High Court hearing that you got a sense that things might be going your way.
I think that's the point where, looking at the faces of the judges as that answer was given, we weren't confident that they would come back 5 minutes after the conclusion of the hearing and announce an acquittal. But I think we're reasonably confident that the appeal was going to be successful at some level.
What were the arguments about motive? I mean, was this man under financial stress?
That's a very interesting question, because ordinarily the motive that people have for arson is that they're in some form of financial distress, and the solution to that is to get the insurance payout. There are a couple of reasons why that doesn't apply in Eamon's case. The first is that the house was underinsured. He'd also just spent something like, I think, 8 months doing renovations on it. The figure of $90,000 was mentioned as having been ploughed into the renovations. There was also a boat in the shed next door, which would have been at risk from the fire, and that was uninsured. Even on that basis, he actually had a motive not to have the house burn. Because he was financially disadvantaged.
But the argument of the prosecution was that he was a complex character, right? And he'd had an argument with his wife that morning, and maybe he was in a black mood, and he just acted impetuously out of anger and frustration.
Yeah, the problem, I think, with that is that there was no objective evidence on which to establish this idea of the black mood. Certainly, he'd been suffering from depression. He'd been treated for, I think, 7 years for depression. But to elevate that to a psychological condition of, quote, black moods, which was, I think, the invention of the Court of Appeal, and then to say this is the motive, seems like a bit of a stretch when you don't have, for example, any real medical or expert evidence about what the incidence of his psychological condition might be and whether they would be likely to give rise to this kind of impetuous or impulsive behaviour.
Mark Thomas, coming back to the big picture, right? You weren't arguing that your client is innocent. You were arguing that the police investigation was profoundly flawed and they did not build a case beyond reasonable doubt that he was guilty. That's really the upshot of what you were doing and what your role was.
Yeah. I mean, the peculiar thing about this is, as a lawyer, I came into the process after the Court of Appeal decision, and so I was just concerned with the High Court appeal. And the High Court is not actually asking the question of, did Eamon set fire to his house? They're asking this very precise legal question of, on the available evidence at trial, was it open to a jury to be satisfied beyond reasonable doubt as to his guilt? So you're not actually inquiring into whether or not he set the fire. That's an entirely different question, which has long since been left behind. It's a strange thing when you're acting as defence counsel in this situation that, from a forensic point of view, that's the question you're engaging with. But because you spend a certain amount of time with the person, you go over the evidence, they tell their story, you also, as a human being, obviously going to get some impression as to whether you think the person has committed the offence or not. Again, not speaking as a lawyer now, but just speaking as someone who spoke to Eamon for quite extended periods of time and who looked at the evidence, I never had any doubt that his version of events was, as near as can be determined, an accurate description of what had happened.
So although it's irrelevant from your perspective whether or not you believe he's innocent, that's kind of where you found yourself.
Yeah, but I said the answer to the question, did I as a person think that he committed the offence, is totally compartmentalised from what you do as a lawyer in the context of a High Court appeal, which is to engage with this question of what was the state of the evidence? What were the shortfalls in the evidence which should have given rise in the jury's mind to reasonable doubt? And it obviously gave rise in the High Court's mind to the five judges who unanimously found that they felt that there was some doubt, which they couldn't dispel by going back to the jury and allowing for the fact that the jury has, in one way, a privileged position because they see the evidence as it comes out. And obviously, I mean, the High Court, after I think 2.5 hours or thereabouts of argument from the Crown and from Stephen Kime, who is senior counsel, adjourned the court, said we'll go away and consider our course of action. And I think it was, the transcript says 5 minutes, I think it might have been a bit under that. So there wasn't a great deal of debate between the five members of the court. They were unanimous and they were quite clear that not only were they going to allow the appeal, but they weren't going to order a retrial. They were actually going to enter an acquittal, which means that he can't be retried again for the offence.
Let's place this case in a wider context. Mark Thomas, interestingly, the High Court will be asked very soon. I think it's on the 11th of March.
I think the 11th, yeah.
They will be hearing the appeal of George Pell. It is, of course, at totally different case, totally different facts, totally different offences. But again, the High Court will be asked to entertain that fundamental question, is this guilty verdict or are these guilty verdicts unsafe and unreasonable? That is, at the end of the day, the same question.
It's the same question, but I guess the way in which you approach it differs because of the stark differences between the nature of the evidence. As I understand it, the Pell defence focuses on the idea that in order for the offences to have occurred, there were a whole pile of other things that needed to occur which were inherently improbable, such that ordinarily the cardinal would have been out the front of the church talking to the congregation at the end of the service. Ordinarily, cardinals are not left on their own. They always have someone in attendance. And so the argument is going to be that you look at all of these improbabilities and they add up to a situation where any jury ought to have had some reasonable doubt as to whether or not, in a practical sense, that offence could have occurred.
So the argument of Pell's defence team will be about the improbabilities, but yours was very much about the flaws in the investigation, which is quite a separate issue.
Well, the flaws in the investigation, to the extent that because there was no proper investigation ever carried out, that left what we would have described as gaping holes in the prosecution case. The High Court focused very much on the one gaping hole, and that was that the Crown couldn't explain how the explosion occurred.
What do you think we should be taking away from this High Court decision, or from the High Court's acquittal and maybe whatever they might say in subsequent written reasons, which might take months to come out?
Yeah, second-guessing the High Court is difficult. But what I think you take away, here you had a police officer and an investigation which starts out with the assumption that one particular person is guilty. And that then tends to taint the entire process of the investigation, such that they then can't present a cogent and coherent and complete case. If it can happen to Eamon, it can happen to any of us. And it's something which we ought to be terribly concerned about, that when police engage in investigations, they should do so with an open mind, and they should follow up on all of the potential suspects rather than just get a tunnel vision and become fixated on one particular person, because that way the evidence always tends to be coloured, and that way the evidence always tends to emerge to confirm. It almost develops what's called confirmation bias.
Barrister Mark Thomas, who was junior counsel for Eamon Coughlin in the High Court. Mark is also a senior lecturer at QUT Law School. This is the Law Report on Radio National. And of course, you can subscribe to the program on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you do like the podcast, please do give us a rating and review. It really helps others find the show. Last week, the New South Wales government introduced legislation into state parliament that will change what evidence a jury can hear in a child sex abuse trial. Now, these legal changes were prompted by the recommendations of the Royal Commission into Institutional Child Sex Abuse, and similar bills will be introduced in other states and territories shortly. So what exactly are the legal changes contained in this legislation? I'm speaking with Professor of Law from UNSW, Annie Cossens. Annie Cossens, what exactly are the legal changes contained in this legislation?
Well, the main one is to do with tendency evidence about a defendant who is charged with a range of child sex offences in a child sexual assault trial. So what I mean by tendency evidence is evidence of prior criminal conduct, of the defendant's sexual interest in children, or tendency evidence about the defendant acting on that sexual interest. That sort of evidence could be in the form of previous convictions or previous charges, or what is more usually the case, allegations by a number of children about his sexual conduct with them.
I understand this legislation also makes it easier for multiple victims to give evidence against the same offender in the one trial rather than having separate trials. Is that right?
Yes, that's the case. These changes are designed to encourage judges to hold joint trials of all the charges against a defendant rather than separate trials which involve just, say, one or two complainants in separate trials.
How important, in your view, is this legislation?
Oh, yes, it's a terribly important legal reform. What we had prior to that was a number of cases involving judges trying to find the similarities in the tendency evidence and in the charges. And a lot of that discussion about similarities was totally uninformed by what the research evidence says about the behaviour of child sex offenders.
In the past, judges would try and say, okay, we might let this evidence in if there's a clearly kind of established pattern, but you're saying that you need to go beyond the pattern and look at a generalised interest in children or prior offences or prior acquittals, that sort of thing.
That's right. There's quite a bit of evidence to show that a significant minority and sometimes a majority of child sex offenders engage in what's called crossover behaviours. So they might sexually abuse both male and female children, or they might sexually abuse children of different ages, prepubescent, adolescent, even children that are under 1 year of age. And they also engage in a range of different sexual behaviours with different children. So looking for similarities, it's just a totally false way of trying to determine whether tendency evidence has any relevance to a significant extent.
Defence lawyers would say, look, what about the presumption of innocence? If a jury is told about past crimes or very different allegations in time and space and nature, a jury will infer guilt rather than concentrate on the evidence presented relating to this particular charge.
Well, believe it or not, before this legislation came into effect, tendency evidence has a long, long history of being admitted in a whole range of criminal trials. Robbery, murder, negligent driving, a whole range. This is not a new concept. We've had tendency evidence being admitted in trials for more than 100 years. All this new legislation, what the new legislation does is it just tells judges that having a sexual interest in children or acting on that sexual interest is relevant evidence. That's all it does.
Annie Cossins, defence lawyers say that over the last 10 years, the courts have established kind of principles where they will allow for this kind of evidence to be put before a jury, and they will allow for multiple complainants to have their trials heard together. And one of the most prominent was the Hey Dad TV star, Robert Hughes, and his convictions were upheld in the High Court. So why is there the need for this kind of legal reform in each of our state and territory parliaments?
Certainly in New South Wales, New South Wales judges have been much more progressive, if I can put it that way, in admitting this type of evidence in joint trials of sexual abuse charges against both adults and children. The problem arose, of course, with the less progressive approach of the Victorian judges, who showed a greater inclination to hold separate trials where there were a number of complainants, you know, alleging sexual abuse against the same defendant. So the Hughes case was a New South Wales case in which five complainants were able to give their evidence in a joint trial, and many of those complainants were of different ages, and much of the sexual conduct that they alleged against Hughes was different in nature. And the New South Wales trial judge allowed that joint trial to go ahead, and all of that was considered to be a satisfactory approach both by the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal and the High Court. But it is doubtful that had a case like that been heard in Victoria, it is doubtful that that would have been a joint trial.
UNSW Law Professor Annie Cossins, an expert in sexual assault laws, she welcomes the proposed laws. Stephen Odgers SC is a leading Sydney-based criminal defence barrister. He, like many defence lawyers, has concerns about the laws.
The current law is that before evidence of sexual interest in children can be admitted in a criminal trial, it has to be shown that the evidence has significant probative value. That's significant value in supporting a prosecution case, and also that that value substantially outweighs the dangers of unfair prejudice that might arise from the evidence. So what this legislation does is a number of things. Firstly, that second limb of the probative value substantially outweighing the dangers, it no longer has to substantially do so, it just has to outweigh them. In respect of the requirement of significant probative value, the onus has been shifted. So instead of the prosecution having to persuade a judge that the evidence has significant probative value, it's the onus is really put on the defence to show that it doesn't. And indeed, the defence is required to show, quoting from the bill, show sufficient grounds to establish that it doesn't have significant probative value, and also a whole range of considerations that might be relevant to that to be disregarded by the judge unless there are, and I'm quoting, exceptional circumstances.
So it shifts the goalposts in terms of when this evidence about a previous interest in children will be allowed into these sorts of trials. And we're talking about here what, past convictions or other kind of allegations which are not yet necessarily subject to the charges in the trial?
That's right, and indeed they may be allegations of events that have occurred many years in the past. It may not have resulted in a conviction, but somebody might not have gone to the police but has come forward and wants to give evidence of some event, which isn't the subject of a criminal charge, but the evidence is being led in the trial of another charge, perhaps in respect of another complainant.
I suppose what you have here are people like the Royal Commission and people who advocate for survivors saying this information helps build up a real picture of who the accused is and what their history is. And defence lawyers say, well, there's a danger here that rather than looking at just at the evidence which goes to this particular complainant and this particular charge, we're going much, much more broadly than that, and that will prejudice the jury.
Yes, I think that's a fair summary. The law of evidence in this country, as indeed in many other countries, has limited the admission of evidence of previous, I'll call it criminal conduct. So, I mean, if you're charged with a break and enter, the fact that you've got a 10-year-old conviction for stealing, it will normally not be admitted unless it can be shown that it has real value in establishing the guilt of the particular charge before the court. A jury might say, well, look, we're not really prepared to give the benefit of the doubt to this guy for these charges because if he didn't do this, he probably did something else.
Stephen Hodges, SC, do you think this new legislation is actually going to shift the goalposts, is actually going to change the kind of balance in a profound way from a defence lawyer's perspective? And do you think, from your perspective, that that's a dangerous thing?
Look, it's a bit difficult to predict. One reason it's difficult to predict is it's very badly drafted legislation, in my view. It's been drafted by what I would call a committee of bureaucrats, and limiting judicial discretion, telling judges you can't take into account a whole range of relevant circumstances unless there are exceptional circumstances, well, that's going to just confuse everybody. And so the short answer to your question is that I really don't know. The purpose is certainly to let more evidence in, but having said all of that, I don't think it's going to make a great deal of difference.
Stephen Hodges, SC, leading Sydney-based criminal defence barrister, talking there about New South Wales. But it will be interesting to see what the impact of these laws might be in other states and territories. That's it for the Law Report. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.